KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, the investigative journalist Eric Schlosser is our guest. His latest book is about the way the U.S. maintains and manages the large and growing nuclear arsenal. There haven't been any accidental nuclear detonations, of course, but Schlosser says we're better at creating these systems than controlling them, and there have been and will be accidents. His book is called Command and Control. Join us after this.
When you think about Las Vegas, you might picture casinos, opulent hotels, and neon signs, like the Welcome to Fabulous Las Vegas sign, Circus Circus, or that huge cowboy on Fremont Street, Vegas Vic. Turns out, lots of those signs were made by a company headquartered right here in Utah. KUER's Julia Richa used to live in Nevada. That's where she fell in love with neon signs and even started a story on them, although she couldn't quite finish it until she moved to Salt Lake City. Download the next episode of More to Say, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few years ago, the investigative journalist Eric Schlosser wrote a book about the American nuclear weapons arsenal. He wanted to know just how safe it was. He says he wasn't interested in the nuclear arms race, necessarily. He was more interested in the systems themselves. You know, the day-in, day-out management of the weapons, the guys who fix things and maintain things, the technicians, the pilots, the guys who have shifts in missile silos. And one of the things he learned is that while the U.S. is great at creating these complex technologies, we're not so good at controlling them. And because of this, there have been accidents. No accidental nuclear detonations, of course, but there have been about 32 so-called broken arrow incidents. These are accidents or times when someone loses track of a nuclear weapon. Schlosser's book is built around one of these stories, a massive explosion at a Titan II missile silo in Damascus, Arkansas, 1980. This was when a worker who was doing some routine maintenance dropped a wrench that basically pierced the rocket. You probably have heard about this story. It's come to be known as the Damascus Incident. In our conversation with Schlosser, we talked about Damascus, but mostly the larger questions of how you maintain such a powerful arsenal without being destroyed by it. His book is called Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Incident, and the Illusion of Safety. We began our conversation with Schlosser talking about the first time he saw a Titan II missile. He says, up close, it seemed like a living, breathing thing.
You know, I grew up during the Cold War, and we lived with a kind of a daily anxiety that the world might end any day. It's hard to remember now, but and what's terrible is through declassification of a lot of documents, we now know we came close to an all-out nuclear war with the Soviet Union in the early 80s when I was at college. Yet there always was this sort of abstract feeling, are these things really out there? Do these weapons really work? Or is it all just some con game? And that's why when I was able to watch the launch of a Titan II missile at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, it hit home, and it hit home in a very visceral way. I mean, I stood next to the missile the night before the launch, and it had all this cooling equipment humming and whirring, and it did feel like a living, breathing thing. And I was trained in the use of a breathing apparatus, kind of a gas mask with an air pack in case something went wrong with the launch. And the officer who was my host, he had never stood that close. We stood scary close to this thing. I mean, not right up to it, but as close as you could be when it launched.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most powerful experiences I've had, watching this 10-story missile take off and the roar of it, the heat, it was incredible. And then, you know, the last time you could see it, it was already over Mexico. Mm-hmm. And what hit me is these things work.
Yeah.
They really do. And that there were hundreds of missiles, not exactly the same design, but you know, with the same aim in mind, in silos all over the United States, all over Russia. And if somebody gave the order, they would take off and do their job. one of the real dangers right now with a nuclear threat is these weapons are literally out of sight and out of mind. They are hidden underground. They are on submarines underwater. We don't see them. We don't think about them. And when I saw that launch and I felt that launch and heard that roar, I realized, my God, these things work.
One of the things you say in the book early on is that you're not going to write about arms control treaties and diplomacy. The thing that you are really focused on, and this seems important, is, as you say, operating systems. And like the larger theme is how this mixture of human fallibility and, as you put it, technological complexity can lead to a disaster. Like, we're really good at creating complex technologies, but how good are we at controlling them, I guess?
Yeah. You know, I hadn't read anything that explored the day-in, day-out management of nuclear weapons. Mm. You know, these are machines. It's like a car. It's like, you know, an airplane. You need mechanics. You need fuel. You know, there's problems every day that require repair. And I told this, you know, I got into the subject through this one story that I think is a very dramatic, extraordinary story. But I was interested in how do you run a system like this and how do you run it safely and securely? And on the one hand, you know, we and the Russians have done an unbelievable job, and the Chinese. I mean, there have been 125,000 nuclear weapons built since 1945, and only two of them have destroyed cities. So, I mean, in terms of technology management, that is an incredible, incredible achievement. But if I were to read tomorrow afternoon that a city somewhere had been destroyed in a nuclear weapons accident, I wouldn't think, oh my God, I can't believe it. It would be, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because these are very difficult systems to manage. And one of the central themes of the book is that from the very first detonation of a nuclear weapon in the Trinity test in Alamogordo in 1945 to this moment, this technology has always been on the verge of slipping out of our control. And, you know, commercial air travel is the safest way to go from one place to another. And it's amazing, these machines that fly through the air and take us where we want to go. But every now and then, one of them goes wrong and the plane crashes, and it's terrible for the victims of the crash and it's terrible for their families. But the devastation is somewhat limited. Mm-hmm. And if a nuclear weapon system goes wrong, the level of devastation just is unimaginable. Hundreds of thousands, millions, and this sounds ridiculous, but an accidental nuclear war that could kill hundreds of millions.
Yeah.
And so people need to think about this and know about it.
It's so interesting, the living on that knife edge of risk and still pushing forward. You've written about, for example, how right before we detonated the very first nuclear device, there was some uncertainty about whether or not doing this would actually be the end of Earth as we know it, but we went ahead anyway.
Yeah. They were concerned. The Manhattan Project physicists, the most brilliant minds in the world, were unsure if setting off a nuclear device would set the Earth's atmosphere on fire and kill every living thing on Earth. And they, you know, they felt statistically confident that wouldn't happen. But there was an element of uncertainty. And I write in the book, there was a young physicist, Viktor Weisskopf, who had spent a year doing calculations about whether the Earth's atmosphere would catch on fire. And he was 10 miles away from that test in the New Mexico desert. And when he saw the flash and he felt the heat on his face, in that moment, he genuinely believed that the Earth's atmosphere had caught on fire and everything on Earth was going to die. And we're very fortunate that he was wrong. But what's interesting is, you know, 6-7 years later, they were going to test the first thermonuclear device, a hydrogen bomb, and they had to do all those calculations all over again.
Yeah.
And they weren't 100% certain until they set it off and, you know, the atmosphere didn't catch on fire. It turned out the atmosphere reflected the heat and didn't absorb it and catch on fire. But there's just been this sense of uncertainty, of never being fully in control of this technology from July of 1945 until February of 2018.
One of the questions that you get at in the book is, can the United States, or really, I guess, any country, provide a reasonable degree of protection from nuclear war? And there's this issue that you write about, this conflict in the military, for example, the always never dilemma. And you mentioned General Curtis LeMay, how he, as he put it, he said it didn't make any sense to put money into holes in the ground to crawl into, rather spend it on offensive weapons to deter it in the first place. So this give and take about how much you protect and then how aggressive you get in just ramping up the arms race, that seems to be a kind of constant conflict for us.
Yeah. You know, the always never dilemma has to do with the control of nuclear weapons and their safety mechanisms. So on the one hand, if you're going to have to use nuclear weapons, you always want them to work the way that they're supposed to work, because you don't want to risk the life of a pilot, for example, flying all the way with a weapon that then drops and doesn't work because it has too many safety mechanisms in it that gets in the way of it doing what it's supposed to do. On the other hand, you never want a weapon to detonate by accident. You never want someone who's unauthorized to use the weapon to be able to get hold of it and use it. And so there's this contradiction in designing a weapon between always and never. And again and again, you find in the history of the American nuclear weapon program, there was an emphasis on always as opposed to making the weapons extra safe. So for much of the Cold War, we had weapons that could detonate during an accident with catastrophic effects because there was a decision made that we want to make sure they always work when we need to use them. I must say, this is true for every nuclear power that decides to have these weapons. And right now, it's most likely that North Korea has no safety mechanisms or very, very rudimentary safety mechanisms because it's such a challenge to make these things go off in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a real issue because the long-range weapon that North Korea has developed is basically like the Titan II missile in my book. It's a 1950s-era design. It has two different highly volatile rocket propellants in it. And if they have an accident that involves the explosion of one of their missiles, they very well could get an accidental nuclear detonation. And that would be very dangerous, dangerous, not just for the North Koreans, but there's a major city in China not that far away from their test site. The other issue that you mentioned about, whether we try to build bomb shelters and spend money trying to protect ourselves, or whether we have a nuclear weapon systems and strategy that will deter an attack on the United States, that was always, a debate through the Cold War. And, we just saw with the Hawaii alert, it's still an issue today. I mean, is there a way to protect your population from a nuclear war, or is the best strategy to just make sure you never have that nuclear war in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Eric, at what point does it occur to the military or the government of the United States that this may not be as safe as we thought? I mean, you tell the story about this B-52 that breaks up over North Carolina. I think it's called the Goldsboro accident, and you write about. And you say the only thing that really prevented a detonation of a nuclear device was one safety switch.
It was not only one safety switch, but it was such a crude, rudimentary device. It's incredible. After the book was published, I was invited to the Sandia National Laboratory, which is one of our weapons labs that is responsible for the engineering of our nuclear weapons. And they allowed me to hold that switch that was in that bomb in 1961. That Wow. prevented catastrophic explosion. And it looked like a light switch from 1950 too. I mean, you feel like the underwriter's laboratory wouldn't even allow you to put that in your home today. It was so crude. And what's really scary is other switches of that exact design were later found to be defective in other bombs, and they had to redesign it. So if one of those defective switches had been in that bomb that day, you would have had a powerful hydrogen bomb detonating in North Carolina and sending lethal radioactive fallout up the East Coast as far as Washington, D.C. President John F. Kennedy had just been inaugurated, I can't remember, a week and a half earlier, and it's one of those things that could have changed the course of history. It wouldn't have been as optimistic a period in the United States if we had lost, you know, a state and had to, you know, have other states contaminated with radioactive fallout. So again and again, we've come close. And one of the things that happened after that accident is the fact that the safety switch worked persuaded people that these weapons are safe.
Yeah.
And there were all kinds of problems that were missed and weren't diagnosed for years. There was just this attitude, well, it hasn't happened, it won't happen, it can't happen. But if it had happened, there would have been a very different attitude towards the safety of our nuclear weapons that day.
One of the questions that comes up, and you've written about this at various places, is who has control in those early days about, like, who can set off one of these things? And you write about this debate, for example, early on over the H-bomb, you know, the super bomb, and how it strengthened the influence of the military in nuclear weapons policy and diminished the stature of the Atomic Energy Commission. And so for a while, the custody, as you put it, of the country's nuclear arsenal was kind of in the hands of the military. It wasn't, I mean, it was certainly the job of the president, but the president could, if he was not available or incapacitated or something like that, it was like, as you put it, it was kind of Dr. Strangelove could actually have happened at some point.
Yeah. And again, this is all about well-intended people struggling with the issue of how to control this lethal technology. After the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, people were pretty freaked out about how powerful nuclear weapons were.
Yeah.
And what the implications were. I mean, one bomb destroying an entire city. It used to take hundreds of planes with thousands of bombs to do that. So there was a debate in Congress about who should control nuclear weapons, and the decision was made there should be civilian control, and the only person who should be authorized to use a nuclear weapon should be the President of the United States. So civilian control was enshrined by the Atomic Energy Act. But then it got more complicated. It got much more complicated because if the United States was going to be under attack, you might need to use these weapons very quickly. And so gradually the military got more and more control of the operational details of nuclear weapons. And eventually it got to the point where, yes, technically, the president's the only one who has the authority to order the use of a nuclear weapon. But under the Eisenhower administration, that authority was delegated to lower-level military officers. Because what happens if we're under attack and no one can reach the president? Yeah. Someone has to be able to, you know, retaliate. And it got to the point by the time that President Kennedy took office that relatively low-level officers on the front line in NATO, in Europe, could order the use of nuclear weapons on the battlefield if they felt like their battalion was going to be overrun by the Soviets. And the dangerous thing about that is once the first nuclear weapon detonates in the field, are you going to be able to control the escalation of the conflict?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we have ballistic missile submarines that have very powerful missiles and warheads. And most likely, the captains of those submarines have the authority to use nuclear weapons if the United States is destroyed or the president has been killed as a way of retaliating against the Russians. The problem also, once you delegate the authority to these officers at a lower level, They may make a decision during warfare that could lead to a world war, or they may just make a decision on their own. Dr. Strangelove is an incredible movie, and it's an outrageous farce about a general who wants to start World War III. And sadly, Dr. Strangelove is probably the most accurate depiction of the command and control system that existed at that point in the early 60s that there's ever been. I mean, if you were to read the newspapers in that time, they didn't give as accurate a depiction of the command and control procedures as Dr. Strangelove does.
Right.
And what's crazy is that at that point, there were no locks on our weapons. There were codes that gave instructions to our officers about when to use them. But if a fighter pilot with a hydrogen bomb and NATO in 1961 had wanted to take off with his plane and go bomb Moscow, there was nothing to prevent him from doing that. And the only thing that prevented that sort of unauthorized use of nuclear weapons during most of the Cold War was the professionalism and the discipline of our officer corps. But if one of those guys had wanted to start World War III, just like in Dr. Strangelove, there was absolutely nothing to prevent them from doing so in a mechanistic, technical way.
Yeah. Well, say something about these code switches that I guess it's the Kennedy administration that first puts these into place, like these permissive action links, these PALs.
Yeah.
Say something about that.
Well, I mean, there was a realization that, you know, not just an American officer, but maybe an Italian or a German or, you know, a British, one of our NATO allies could just take one of our weapons and use them. And so there was a frantic effort to install coded locks in the weapons. And the weapon would not detonate unless you had the right code that you could enter into this electromechanical lock. And that was, you'd think that would be a very obvious thing, but it really wasn't done on a wide scale until the mid-1960s. And when it came to our own weapons on American bombers and missiles, it really wasn't done until the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, if two members of a missile launch crew wanted to launch one of their missiles, you know, in the 1960s in the United States, they could have just done it. Yeah. There was nothing to prevent them from doing it. Now, when you talk about these permissive action links inside the gravity bombs themselves, you know, they would prevent someone from using it immediately, but somebody who really understood the weapon design and had enough time could probably remove one of these locks and use the weapons. Now, our gravity bombs today have those locks in them. They're much more sophisticated. But what they do is they really delay the use of the weapon. They don't necessarily prevent the unauthorized use. So ideally, none of our weapons will get stolen, because I'd prefer that someone not use them.
Eric Schlosser. His writing has appeared in Rolling Stone, The Atlantic, The New Yorker. He's the author of several books. His most recent is the one we're talking about. It's called Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Incident, and The Illusion of Safety. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Is something missing from your morning breakfast or evening dinner prep? How about NPR's critically acclaimed sound-rich stories alongside KUER's in-depth local news? Now with smart speakers, listening just became a whole lot easier. Tell Alexa or your Google Home to play NPR, and they'll take you right to KUER's live stream. Unlock the world of public radio with just your voice by telling Alexa or Google to play NPR, and never get stuck in the driveway again.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the investigative journalist Eric Schlosser. We're talking about his book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Incident, and The Illusion of Safety. I have to say, there was this kind of remarkable incident you write about in the book. There are a lot of them, actually, but there's this drill, the civil defense drill conducted during the Eisenhower administration. I think this was 1955, called Operation Alert. And I just wanted to read, there was from this report, what they found was that out of a population of 165 million, only I put that in air quotes, only 8.2 million people would be killed. 6.6 million people would be wounded. And you say that Eisenhower said publicly, that gives me great encouragement. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about this because he says one thing publicly, but privately he's really stunned, I think, it seems.
Eisenhower had many flaws, but when it came to keeping the United States out of a nuclear war, he was quite heroic in many ways. Mm-hmm. He was trapped by this dynamic of the arms race, and he wound up building up our arsenal enormously. But he had seen the devastation of Europe in the Second World War firsthand, and he had no desire to be involved in a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. The public pronouncements were basically designed to keep the American people calm. Everything's okay. Everything's under control. We have a way to survive a nuclear war. If the worst comes and we go to war, you and your family will be okay by going in your basement. And the reality that Eisenhower knew was exactly the opposite. There would have to be martial law installed, you know, imposed in the United States. There would be nowhere near enough medical facilities to deal with all the wounded. At one point, he even, you know, said privately, "We don't have enough bulldozers to scrape the bodies off of the ground." It was very, very sobering. And, you know, their casualty estimates, even the ones that were sincere, turned out to be huge, huge underestimates. And it's, you know, it's unimaginable what would have happened if there had been a full-scale nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union. The latest studies, you know, in the last few years suggest that the detonation of only 150 to 250 relatively small atomic bombs in a war between India and Pakistan might lead to as many as a billion casualties worldwide because of the effects on the climate. And at the height of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, we had between the two countries about 64,000 nuclear weapons. Much more powerful than anything India and Pakistan have today. Orders of magnitude more powerful. So the deaths would have been measured in the hundreds of millions, if not billions. And it's incredible how close we came to a nuclear war with the Soviet Union again and again during the Cold War. And it's almost miraculous that it never happened. But just because something like that didn't happen, as I said earlier, doesn't mean it won't happen in the future. And that's why people need to remember that this threat still exists and that there are things that we can do to greatly reduce it.
Well, it's interesting. One of the things you've talked about, and in the book you mentioned that half of the American population either wasn't born or were just small kids when the Soviet Union disbanded. So while you and I in the 80s were freaking out about the potential for nuclear weapons, this awareness is not really present anymore, even though the danger is still, it's almost exactly the same in many ways and maybe worse.
Well, sadly, William Perry, who I've come to know and is a great, great American, he was Secretary of Defense during the Clinton administration. He's an engineer. He's been involved in nuclear weapons issues for more than half a century. And he's a calm, rational, grounded person. He thinks that the risk of a city being destroyed by a nuclear weapon is maybe greater now than during the Cold War. Not necessarily the risk of an all-out nuclear war, but of a nuclear catastrophe, because so many countries now have nuclear weapons, and because of the rising tension between the United States and Russia. You know, sadly, many of the people who remember the Cold War just assumed that the threat went away when the Cold War ended, and it didn't. So we have this danger. There are almost 15,000 nuclear weapons in the world, and all the countries that have nuclear weapons are modernizing their arsenals right now. But what we're lacking is public awareness and public discussion and public debate of what I think is the greatest threat that we face. I mean, climate change is an enormous threat, but the detonation of a nuclear weapon is going to be instantaneous and irreversible. And I think I said this to you earlier, when, you know, before we were doing the interview. I'm now 10 years into the subject. I am not apocalyptic. I don't think we're all doomed. I don't lie awake in bed at night worrying about nuclear weapons, but I am really concerned. And I think that we need public debate and discussion, and we need a new anti-nuclear movement. It's remarkable how effective the anti-nuclear movement of the 1980s really was. There were demonstrations all over the United States and in Western Europe, and those demonstrations played a major role in ensuring that the Cold War ended peacefully. And they helped turn Ronald Reagan from a huge believer in nuclear weapons into a strong advocate for abolishing them. So people need to educate themselves and get active. The alternative to that is to have crucial decisions about our safety being made by a small number of people in Washington, D.C., in Moscow, that could have, you know, terrible consequences for the world.
You write about how the Air Force's focus on tactical warfare. It's like they're shifting their focus. So they're focusing on tactical warfare now, and that's led to these severe, this severe neglect, you say, of its strategic mission. And nuclear weapons have, to some officers, started to seem, in some ways, at least after the Cold War, almost irrelevant. You say ambitious officers have wanted nothing to do with them.
Yeah. You know, there's one of the problems I've had in a lot of the writing about nuclear weapons is it's demonized. And I love Strangelove, but, you know, Strangelove really parodied the Air Force officers who handled nuclear weapons and made them all out to seem like mad bombers wanting to go to war and drop hydrogen bombs on other people. And you know, I've spent a lot of time now both with officers who served during the Cold War and since my book came out with officers who are now in charge of our nuclear weapons. And I can't tell you how much respect I have for them. And if anybody is aware of the dangers and the risks of nuclear weapons, it's the people who are in charge of them, both in the Cold War and today. Our military, for the last 25 years, has really moved away from considering our nuclear arsenal of central importance like it was during the Cold War. There's been a shift towards precision weapons that minimize civilian casualties. And I'm not going to defend how drones are used or not used, but you know, the thinking behind drone warfare is avoiding unnecessary casualties and just killing the handful of people who we want to eliminate. Nuclear weapons are the opposite of that. Nuclear weapons are the most non-discriminatory weapons that you can imagine. They kill huge numbers of people. They have all kinds of other weapon effects like, you know, radioactive contamination. So our military has really moved away from believing nuclear weapons are of central importance. But as a result, the weapons we have are getting very old. Yeah. You know, the Minuteman missiles we have in the ground were supposed to be retired more than 30 years ago.
Wow.
Our submarines are past their, you know, due date for when they were supposed to be taken out of service. And our principal nuclear bomber, the B-52, you know, we haven't built one since the Kennedy administration. So this is a very good time to be having a debate about, do we need these things? How many of them do we need? Which kinds do we need? What are they ultimately for? The Trump administration has just issued a new nuclear posture review that calls for basically rebuilding the kind of arsenal we had throughout the Cold War and spending over $1 trillion to do it. And this seems like a very good time to debate, you know, do we need these things? Why do we need them? How would we use them? All these basic questions. And that debate really is not happening in a big way among the American people.
I got really nervous about a couple of these recent incidents. 2003, you point out, half of the Air Force units responsible for nuclear weapons failed safety inspections. In 2006, these fuse assemblies of four Minuteman III missiles were accidentally shipped from here, in Utah, the Hill Air Force Base, accidentally shipped to Taiwan. August of 2007, six cruise missiles armed with nuclear warheads, basically misplaced for a time.
Yeah. You know, it was, and this is relevant to what the Trump administration wants to do. They had these cruise missiles that were dual use. That means the cruise missiles could have conventional explosives in them, or they could have powerful nuclear warheads. And this team just loaded the cruise missiles onto a bomber, thinking that they had conventional warheads on them, didn't bother to check to see that they had powerful nuclear warheads on them. And it was a breakdown of the system on so many levels, because the guys removing the cruise missiles from the bunker should have looked at what kind of warhead they had on them. But so should the crew, and particularly the captain of the plane that they were loaded on. They were loaded on a plane. They were flown to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. And the plane just sat on the runway in a relatively unguarded area, you know, for hours with nuclear weapons unguarded. And that could have been catastrophic on so many levels. And it pointed to not one person's problem, not two people's problem, but an entire system for managing nuclear weapons that broke down in a major, major way. I mean, at that point, they didn't even have barcodes on the weapons or things like barcodes. Yeah. They just had serial numbers that people were writing down by hand as a way of tracking them. Since then, there's been a real examination and additional resources put into how we're managing our arsenal, but these are very old, old systems. I mean, our Minuteman launch complexes have computers in them that date back 30 years at least and use 8-inch floppy disks. This is a system that is very old, and the part that I'm most concerned about is the command and control system,
yeah.
the communications software, like I said, the computers, the technical means for making sure these things don't launch are really old. And we can have a big debate on do we need new submarines or not need new submarines, do we need new missiles or not need new missiles. But I would say the place that we need to be investing immediately is billions of dollars if we're going to have these incredibly lethal weapons to make sure that they don't get used by mistake, that there's not some breakdown in communications. And that should happen next week.
There was this, just a few years ago while testifying before Congress, the head of the U.S. Strategic Command, this was General Robert Keller, was testifying and was asked whether or not Russia and China had the ability to prevent a cyber attack, a hacker basically coming in and launching one of their nuclear missiles. And he didn't know. He didn't know the answer. He couldn't really answer that.
Yeah.
I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because that seems to me to be a critical issue, whether or not some hacker, some cyber attack is going to be able to launch a nuclear missile.
It's a huge problem. And General Keller was talking about, could someone hack into the Chinese or Russian systems and launch a missile with a nuclear warhead? He said he didn't know the answer. So that's scary. But we have to be very worried about our own system. I mean, we had 50 of our Minuteman missiles suddenly go offline in Wyoming and I think in Colorado,
yeah.
Which meant that the launch officers could not communicate with their missiles for almost an hour. Now, that's alarming. And it turned out, the Air Force says, that there was a computer chip, a circuit board that was misaligned and had cut off communication, and there was never any danger of a launch. But you know, in 2018, there are hackers getting into anything and everything. And the worst case scenario would be if they hack into our early warning system or Russia's early warning system, mm-hmm. and spoof it into believing there's an all-out attack going on. I mean, I know that was the plot of War Games, this Matthew Broderick film of 30 years ago, but that is something people are worried about right now. A hacker could also get into the system and, like the problem in Wyoming, render our missiles inoperable. But in many ways, the most likely scenario is to create uncertainty in the system. Hmm. Hack into the system, and if you are in charge of incredibly powerful nuclear weapons, you want to know they're going to launch when you want to launch them, and you're going to want to know for sure they're not going to launch when they're not supposed to. And it's that uncertainty that can screw up the whole system. The Air Force has said that they said that these 1980s old IBM computers, maybe it's good that we have them because they're more difficult to hack. But the Air Force is now planning to upgrade its entire command and control system. I support that completely. And no, we should spare no expense in making sure that these systems cannot easily be hacked. One of the problems, no matter how cleverly you design it, is the insider threat.
Yeah.
You know, you look at Snowden. Snowden was a relatively low-level contractor at the NSA who was able to get access to the top secrets, some of which the President of the United States, Obama, probably didn't even know about. So when you have insiders, they can do all kinds of mischief. And it bears noting that the NSA is responsible for the launch codes of our nuclear weapons and for the cryptographic equipment that, you know, decodes those codes. Now, there's no evidence that Snowden got into that, but it gets back to where we began this conversation.
Yeah.
These systems are imperfect because they're designed by human beings. They're always going to be flawed, and it's just a constant effort. It's just constant vigilance to find where these mistakes are and prevent these mistakes from being catastrophic.
There's this passage from your book I was reading. Of course, it's been a few years since the book was first published, and you say in it, as tensions between Russia and the U.S. have eased, the risk of an accidental war has diminished, which seems so quaint now.
I know.
Now the relationship between us and Russia is very much in question.
Yeah. Ernest Moniz, who was Secretary of Energy in the Obama administration and brilliant, brilliant physicist at MIT, and former Senator Sam Nunn, who probably knew more about nuclear weapons than any other member of the Senate and played a huge role in safely getting fissile material and nuclear weapons out of the former republics of the Soviet Union after the Cold War ended, a great man. They wrote an editorial about the great danger of an accidental war or nuclear accidents because of the renewed tension between the United States and Russia. These are like the plots of a crappy Hollywood film, but now it's our reality.
Yeah.
And people need to know about it, and people need to get engaged.
Your book is built largely around this Damascus accident. That's one. And people should go to the book and read about that story. It's frightening and remarkable and has some terrific characters in it. In some ways, that's the great strength of the book, is these characters. And in some ways, it's almost a theme, it seems, in your reporting of this story, that it's that these technicians, some of the, in the case of this incident, this accident in Damascus, this explosion, you know, these technicians were young. They were 19, 20 years old. But then there's also this kind of these heroic efforts among them, their commitment. I just think it's really interesting that, again, on the ground, these people who are basically acting in heroic ways, many of them.
Yeah, I wanted to tell the story of extraordinary personal heroism during the Cold War. You know, there have been lots of World War II stories, and yet there were young men who risked their lives and sometimes lost them in order to prevent nuclear catastrophes, in order to prevent nuclear war. And so this accident that I wrote about with the Titan II missile in Damascus, Arkansas, was one of those stories. And I came to know some of these guys. I can't tell you how much I like them and admire them. And it's insane how young they were and how young the people right now in charge of our nuclear weapons are. Now, maybe I'm just getting really old. I'm in my mid-50s. But, you know, these are guys with high school degrees who are 18, 19 years old in charge of the most powerful weapons ever built. In the Damascus accident, you know, the warhead involved with the Damascus, the warhead involved in the accident at Damascus was the most powerful warhead the United States ever built.
Yeah.
I mean, that one warhead had more than three times the explosive force of all the bombs used by all the armies in the Second World War combined, including both atomic bombs. One weapon. And you had 18, 19, 20-year-old kids not only working on it, but risking their lives to prevent it from detonating in this accident and destroying the state of Arkansas and, you know, sending, again, radioactive fallout either up the East Coast or into the Midwest. I saw a recent video that the Air Force put out about their nuclear weapon technicians today. And one of the guys in that video looked like he was a sophomore in high school.
Yeah.
And I'm not besmirching his capability. And they come, you know, the Air Force and the weapons labs come out with checklists, and you're supposed to do everything by the checklist. And so I'm not challenging their competency. It's just, oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to think of, you know, 45-year-old, sober, grounded people handling our nuclear weapons. My son is 25 years old, and I could brag about him forever, and he is smart, sweet, stable, grounded. But at 25, he'd be kind of a senior nuclear weapon technician, and it's like, oh my gosh. I mean, in my book, the lead technician who knows more about nuclear weapons than anyone at the base, at Little Rock Air Force Base, who just risks his life to save this missile and prevent a catastrophe, he's 25.
Yeah. Is that Alan?
And this is Kennedy.
Jeff Kennedy.
You know, he's in the book, he's acknowledged to be the guy who knows more about this weapon system than anyone on the base, and he's 25.
Yeah.
And his decisions and decisions, you know, of other guys his age throughout the Cold War were the difference between safety and catastrophe.
But here's the thing that's so interesting, Eric, is that after the accident in Damascus, it was ruled a human error.
Yeah.
Which on one hand is true. But all of the characters involved in that really bristled at that idea of human error, because technically it was true, but this should have been a system that where basically this big socket wrench falling and creating this, that should not have happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the most simplistic way, obvious way, yeah, it's human error. A guy dropped a tool, it hit the missile, caused a fuel leak. That was the cause of the accident. But the real human error is to create a system with the most powerful warhead we ever built that could detonate because someone drops a tool.
Right.
But that's not what the Air Force wanted to stress. And it was, you know, the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan and the Cold War was raging again. And so rather than admit error, rather than admit that they had an aging, obsolete nuclear weapon system that was prone to accidents, that would have been not only publicly embarrassing, but maybe, you know, they would have had to take all these missiles out of service. They publicly chose to blame the guy who dropped the tool. They publicly chose to blame these ordinary working class guys. And one of the real goals of my book was to kind of reverse the perception that these guys were to blame, that it was their fault, to really honor their service and to depict their extraordinary heroism. I mean, these guys were treated terribly after the accident because the Air Force needed once again assure the public everything's okay. There's nothing wrong with our weapon system. It was human error. We've fired that guy. And the reality, as I show in the book, was very different. It was a very dangerous weapon system, and we're very fortunate that it didn't go off.
If there's any message to preach in the book you write, it's just the fact that humans are imperfect.
We are, and maybe that should lead us to be humble about the things that we make. I am not a Luddite. I love high-tech stuff. I love seeing a Tesla orbiting the Earth and headed towards Mars. I'm a great believer in, you know, technological advance, but there are certain technological systems we have to be very humble about and very wary about. If these machines can destroy the Earth, then maybe we shouldn't build them. And if the catastrophic effects of an error extend beyond a few hundred people or a few thousand people and can kill hundreds of millions and poison the land, we need to be extra vigilant about these technologies, you know. And I made the analogy earlier about the airliner, you know. It's terrible. It's terrible when you have an accident like that, or a car accident, or a fire in a building because of faulty wiring. But we accept these risks as a part of modern life. Do we need to accept the risk of the extinction of all life on Earth because of some of the machines we've built? You know, maybe we shouldn't make them. And at the very least, I mean, I'm a huge supporter of abolishing nuclear weapons. I don't think that's going to happen the day after tomorrow. But the fewer of these machines that we have, the more carefully they are guarded, the less likely we are to have a catastrophe. And unfortunately, if you read the news and you look at the new Trump weapon policy, we're heading in the opposite direction. We're heading towards a new arms race with Russia. And as I said earlier, it's almost miraculous that the last arms race ended without cities getting destroyed. I think it's very unwise to assume another arms race is going to end as happily.
That's Eric Schlosser. His book is called Command and Control: Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Incident, and the Illusion of Safety. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Claire Jones. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.